Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog Live here on YouTube every single Friday and Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Tonight, we have a really cool show. We're going to do Q&A. Unfortunately, Mr. Tristan can't join us this evening. However, it's me, Andre, from Norway, and Wolfman, and we're going to do some Q&A. But before we get started answering your guys' questions and getting into all that kind of stuff, make sure to go check out our boy, Neil John, at facebook.com/IronAgeJody. You want to check out some authentic Vedic astrology. I'm telling you guys, this stuff is so cool. It is really, really cool. It will blow your mind. I absolutely love it. I get messages all the time of folks that went over there and got a reading from Mr. Neil John, and they were so impressed. He's backlogged right now with all the stuff that he's doing. He's moving up in the world. So if you want to get in there, get into the queue, and you want to get your own reading of authentic Vedic astrology, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. Tell him Big Dave sent you over at facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. If you like the Bog, you support the Bog, make sure to go to patreon.com/the Bog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. And we have different things that you can get with the different tiers. You got stickers and mugs and all kinds of stuff like that. And you get RSS feed to get all of our content in audio form right to your device to listen to at work, at home, at the gym, or on commutes. So go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up so you can help us keep the lights on and keep going and expanding and do stuff like that. But if you want to support the Bog another way, make sure to go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and check out some sweet merch. Guys, summer is here. I know you guys, the Esoteric Order of Grill Dads, I know you guys want an artisan chef apron to wear when you're firing up the grill and you got your folks coming over and stuff like that. We got muscle shirts. We got nice summer dresses. We got all kinds of stuff, sweet Bog logos, all kinds of stuff over there, shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop, and you can check out some Bog merch, all kinds of stuff, hats, fanny packs, whatever you can think of, backpacks, stickers, pins, everything. Check it out. shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. I'm going to bring up the questions here right now. However, Mr. Andre, Mr. Wolfman, how we doing tonight, fellas?
Doing good, right. How about you?
Doing really, really good. So we did a Q&A episode, I don't know, months ago. I don't know how long ago. But folks loved it. They absolutely loved it. And they've been harassing me to do another Q&A session. So we love the Bog Lords out there. So we're bringing it to you. We got all kinds of questions here. We're going to try to hit as many of them as we can. Unfortunately, Mr. Tristan's not with us. He's the guy that I like to ask for the sources because he knows the sources and stuff off the top of his head. So we're going to do our best to give our big brain answers to the guys that have lore questions in Tristan's absence. So let's get right into it here. And these are some questions from some guys that were on the YouTube that left questions in the YouTube comments that I haven't been able to answer to. So we're going to hit them now. One of the questions is, and this was on, we did the Heathen Worldview episode a few weeks ago. A guy effectively asks, he said, how do we know what caste we are? How do we know what caste we are now since the caste system is gone? Do you guys have an answer for that?
That's a good question, honestly.
Great question.
It's although you opened with a question where we should have had Tristan.
And he had one, it's perfect for him.
A direct quote from him is that the caste system should not be seen as we see like modern classes today. It's more prescriptive than it's descriptive. You act as the caste you are. You can't pretend to be anything else.
Yeah.
Like your caste would be ultimately kind of self-evident through your behavior and your conduct and how you carry yourself and your interactions with, you know, people, be it your family or your greater community. Like, you know, you can be a janitor and still have, like, you know, the manner of a jarl, necessarily. Like Andre was saying, your socioeconomic status really isn't indicative of class or caste. But, you know, at the same time, you can have people that are very wealthy who, you know, in the soul sense are basically thralls because they're just cogs in the machine, you know, yes men, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as the caste system, it's going to be hard for us to inorganically put it back, right? So those of us that are like wondering what caste we could, and here's a problem that we do have nowadays. You have anybody that has a platform on that has a little bit of savvy with internet marketing, and they have a channel or whatever, and they just call themselves Jarls, right? They think that they, because they have popularity, that therefore they are, or some charisma, that therefore they should be a Jarl or a leader of some kind. And this isn't necessarily true. In fact, the overwhelming majority of time, it's not true. So as far as what caste you are, it's a hard question to answer, because I can't, none of us here can tell you, can look into your soul and say, you are this caste. Most of the time when we talk about castes, we are illustrating the hierarchical nature of our ancestral society. It's not so much saying, everybody get into your caste, everybody get into your role. What we're saying is we're just kind of like demonstrating how ancient Germanic society was hierarchical, and we should take steps to go back into that kind of society. Whether we're, you know, it's going to be kind of hard to push people into thraldom, right? Nobody's going to want to be a thrall, but what we can do is we can say, hey, these guys, you are, because you are so intelligent and you showed natural ability at learning the lore and priestly duties, therefore you are, you know, of the priest class, right? So therefore you should train your kids to be that, because your kids are probably going to be good at it as you are, because that's how, you know, genes work, right? So do you guys have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would say that to keep in mind there's no shame in, you know, being average. You know, like, nothing turns in society without, you know, the average Joe yeah. doing his thing. You know, armies don't march to war without the food that goes into their bellies and the stuff that, you know, the shoes on their feet, so to speak.
Exactly.
So there's no shame in being a tradesman or a blue collar worker or, you know, something like that. Again, caste and socioeconomic status really don't. They don't equate to each other. And also, this is something that you probably really shouldn't spend too much time worrying about, honestly. I mean, as long as you're, you know, faithful of the gods, performing your duties as, you know, a follower of the Aesir and whatnot, and being true to your kin and your community, it's really kind of over the hill at this point. Like, we're not really at the stage where we're organizing, like, you know, theistic / civic societies based on, you know, the religion and whatnot. So for the time being, I would say just, you know, be the best person you can be, as generic as that sounds, and don't worry about it. Don't sweat it too much.
Yeah, don't even worry about it. You will fall into the place, the role, the pecking order in your community based on who you are and what you do. It'll just happen organically. So don't even worry about it. It is what it is. So, and when it comes to, you know, a question that I get, because I am somebody that's very concerned with the working class, the prosperity and the health of the working class, being a working class guy myself, and coming from a working class area, working class family, I'm very much concerned with the prosperity and the well-being of the working class. And sometimes people say, well, how is it that you believe in hierarchy and then also believe in like the working class? Because I'm not somebody that you don't look at the caste system as these guys up top, they dominate and rule over people, but the bottom, it's about class cooperation. There, you know, like Ian just said, there's nothing wrong with being average. Most everybody is average. That's why it's called average. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And in fact, it's a good thing to be average, because everybody has a place. Doesn't matter if you are 80 IQ, you know, whatever, or if you're just a brilliant big brain rich guy, everybody has a place. Everybody has a role within the ecosystem of a Germanic community. Everybody has a work. Everybody has a purpose. Everybody has a role. Everybody has value. It's not like that. So we could talk about cast all night. So let's move on, so we can try to hit some more of these questions. Then we'll see if we got time for the chat. My boy Dino wants to know, who does my hair? I do my hair, Dino. Edward of England. I'm going to read all the questions, even the ones that are funny. So Edward asks, bit of a basic question, how many gods are there? Do we know about all of them, or do we have reason to believe there are unnumbered or unknown or undocumented gods?
Oh, that's a heavy one.
Realistically speaking, I think that there's probably some sort of upper limit to how many gods there are, but I'm not entirely sure we know the names of all of them.
So
there's also the idea that, like, you know, one God taking many guises or something, you know, I don't want to get too deep into that kind of debate, but, you know, just the idea that, you know, one God would have many names and appear in many forms. And so that might lead to the misconception that these are all, in fact, deities unto themselves. And I don't want to comment because I'm pretty ignorant on the subject, but I think if memory serves, there are some of the religions in, like, East Asia, they literally have, like, hundreds of gods, if not thousands, because of, like, different deified geographic locations and ancestors and, like, emperors and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. I'm not really, you know, knowledgeable on that sort of thing in depth.
So evidence points to that there are probably gods whose names have been lost to history. In fact, there's quite a few theories that Odin's real name has been lost to history, and his title is just what is left. Same thing with Yngvifreyr. You know, Frey just means, like, prince. Or,
and,
like,
Tyr too, right?
Yeah, Tyr as well. Because our ancestors believed that calling something by its name was, like, kind of disrespectful of something that was powerful. So you spoke to somebody or something by its title if it held power, right?
It's honorifics in general.
Yeah, like, for example, they believed the bear was a sacred animal, so the bear, or the word Bjorn, just means brown one. Its actual name of the bear was never spoken because they felt like if they said bear too much, bear might show up, or it was disrespectful to the bear. You know, so they called it the brown one, like the great brown one, because, you know, the bear was the king of the animal kingdom to our ancestors. So even the word bear, Bjorn, means brown one. But so let's move on. As far as how many gods there are, so yes, there probably was gods whose names were lost to history that we don't know about, but we can't prove that. So the way that I see it, and this is kind of like the eternal determinist in me, is that we have the names of the gods that we're supposed to know, right? We have exactly what we need to know, and if we maybe a new document will resurface someday and will teach us about other gods, but as far as right now, we know what we're supposed to know. We are where we're supposed to be, and that's all that it is. So our boy Celtic Pepe says, favorite caliber. Now, this is a question that we could go on for a long, long time with favorite caliber of a firearm.
8mm.
What do you like?
8mm.
8mm?
Mauser. So,
it depends what you're using it for. If you ask me what my favorite carry is, I'm a revolver guy. I carry 38 snub nose. That's what I like. But if I, you know, I mean, I also like the 9mm. I like a Glock 9mm. Hey.
If that is a serious question, that probably is one that could have. I have a Glock 9, no, 17, actually, sorry, mm-hmm. G4 17 that I use for carry.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the 1911 45. It's a cool weapon, right? But
it's kind of a boomer gun.
It's kind of a boomer gun. It's too big. It's not comfortable. I like something small. You know, I like a 380 or a 38 snub nose or something like that. But
I used one time and it misfired on the third shot, and I was like, you know what? I'm not a fan of this. Don't think that.
But I think probably what he's alluding to is the great firearm debate, which is AR versus AK.
Oh, AK, more rugged, more durable. But I also live in the desert and the mountains, so I want something that can get, like, clunked around and messed with by the elements and not fuck up too bad. Yeah. But that being said, I have a Ruger AR-556.
Yeah. I don't engage in this debate because I think both firearms are good in different ways. I think that it's apples and oranges comparing these two.
Yeah, it's preference, ultimately. They're both good at what they do.
The 7.62 has better stopping power. It's a more rugged machine. It's something that you can bang around, as Ian said. However, me personally, this is just me, I prefer the AR platform. I like the 5.56. You can carry more rounds. It has less recoil. It's more accurate. I'm more accurate with it. I'm better with it. It's something that my wife can shoot. It's a little it's more finicky and requires more maintenance. But it's just my opinion, right? That's just
Andre's preferences for black powder weapons, because that's
75 caliber muzzle loader. That's That's when firearms peaked.
Yeah. Wait, what kind of cannon do you have?
Culverin.
Oh wow. Okay.
So next question, we got Tango. I guess it's Freeman. We know Freeman. Settle the debate. Are Frigg and Freya different deities, or are they the same one? They're different deities.
They're different. Frigg is the Earth Mother and the wife of Odin. Freya is the twin of Freyr. Like,
yeah.
I'm honestly, that's kind of a question that I almost feel is kind of just an etymological argument that doesn't even really make sense because they both clearly have different form and function. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not trying to put the asker that question down or nothing. I don't mean that at all. Mm-hmm. They're just very clearly distinct, I feel.
Yeah, they. I feel like the debate has been settled for quite a while, especially if you read. I highly suggest anybody that's still interested in this question read William Reeves' book, Odin's Wife. It blows it apart. It's like if you read that book, it's over. You know, it's very clear who Frigg is and that she's very different from Freya. And yeah, so let's go to the next question here. Our boy James asks, would you consider music an essential part of Germanic spirituality? I'll let you guys say, because this is a big one for me.
Oh, absolutely.
there you go.
Honestly, music and singing and everything related to that is basically present in virtually all religions, and by its very nature is sacred.
Yeah, chanting and whatnot too, like the Galder, and a lot of prayer and liturgy. I think it should be sung rather than spoken. But the thing too with music is that I've always found really compelling, and that actually music is one of the things that kind of convinced me that, you know, the gods were real and whatnot. Is because, like, if in Lord of the Rings, for example, you know, Ilvatar or whatever his name is sings creation into existence, like it's all like music of creation and whatnot. And the thing that resonates with me about that is when you think about how music itself, you know, is made through just a series of vibrations and sounds. It's sound waves. It's, you know, kind of almost animalistic at times, in that it can be like a primal beat, or it can be a heavily orchestrated symphony of a bunch of different elements and components. And yeah. To me, the fact that music is so simple in what it is, but can be so complex in what you can make with it, and the fact that even though it's just sound waves, it can really alter so much about human perception. Like, you know, there's music that can make you feel elated and charismatic and heroic and valorous and whatnot. And then there's music that can make you feel dark and, you know, cynical and depressed and negative, and music that makes you feel angry or wrathful. Like, how many metalheads love to go listen to like some like headbang stuff and like go into the mosh pit and get aggressive? Like, it's just fun to do. And the music kind of empowers you to do that in a way, because it goes well with the activity that you're doing. And for such a simple thing, like, you know, the beating of a drum to just psych people up in that way tells me that there's something about it, something that's like psychological or esoteric or something, that is just so intrinsic to man's behavior and his perception of the world and his ability to like speak of it. You know, it's like almost how speech itself is almost kind of sacred in a way. Mm-hmm. Because it's like how you can project your thoughts and like yourself into the physical world in a way. It's kind of like music follows the same design, and it's always kind of had a mystical component to me for that reason.
Yeah.
Specifically talking here about say song, something that has words and such, and it related to the example that you mentioned previously with mentioning bear, Björn, meaning the brown one, was a way of preventing the bear from showing up. Because in a way, if you speak it, it will come. Meaning that words in general have a force of magical power to it, in the most simplistic of terms. So using your own powers that you have by speech, you can turn something completely mundane, like a normal sentence or something, add a little bit of a twist to it, and turn it somehow divine by singing it, because you're adding extra effort, you're adding rhythm, you're adding meaning, metaphor, whatever really, into something else, and creating a concept almost. You're creating an idea of beauty, you're creating art from something mundane, turning it sacred.
And to, you know, all of our lore is in like poetic song or, you know, verse form. It's not like stated oration or whatnot. I think the fact that our ancestors really used song and poetry to convey so many important ideas and concepts speaks, you know, a lot about their cultural values on music and song and whatnot.
The Eddas and such are supposed more or less to be sung.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So my take on this is that in the Eddas, Odin says directly, "Do you know how to sing? Do you know how to sing?" is what he says directly. And what he's asking you here is if you have the ability to sing the sacred songs, to sing Galdr, to perform these things. Song and music are absolutely 100% an essential part of Germanic spirituality. I argue that spoken prayer and things are modern inventions of Protestantism, of people that were anti-music. Now, the idea of spoken, spoken prayer is fine. I'm not saying you can't do that, but the highest form of spiritual expression is in song, is in melody, is, you know, one of his names is Omi, which means he who makes the beautiful sound, one of Odin's names. So is what I consider music an essential part of Germanic spirituality, 100,000%. Everybody should try their best. I know it's tough, but everybody should try their best. And this is something that I tell people when I'm teaching is, sometimes people will say, "Hey, man, I'm a little nervous to like sing in front of people," and you know, that's part of it, man. That's part of it is you overcoming your fear and doing your best to sing, even if you're not that good of a singer, to practice and get better. Let me tell you, there's pretty much no such thing as being tone deaf. Anybody here that's listening, with some practice, you can become at least a serviceable singer. Obviously, there's limits with your vocal talent. Not everybody can hit crazy highs or go real low and have a big, giant range and be a big, you know, be a rock star. Not everybody has that talent. But everybody can at least learn to carry a tune, which is the very base of Galdr. You know what I mean? You don't need these ranges and runs and scales and stuff like that. You can just hold a note. And let me tell you guys, one of the most special experiences that you can have is when you and your clan are all singing these Galdrs in unison. Now, I'm guessing this is Mr. Mark, Neurona Society. He's talking about this. Can you provide an in-depth explanation of what Galdr is and explain the discrepancies in New Age thought on this? So what I just previously said about the idea of spoken prayer, that you can just this is a very New Age idea, that you can just go outside and just talk and the gods will hear you. Our ancestors didn't believe this. They understood that there was a formula that you must use in order to contact and get the attention of the divine. There were formulas, there were steps. It wasn't just make it up and do whatever you want. So this is very much laid out in the Eddas when we look at the sacred meters, Lodahatter and Galdrlag and things like this. When you get into these formulas, there is a formula on how to word our prayers, our Galdrs. And what is Galdr? Galdr or Galdr? Galdr is, for people that aren't familiar, is the Germanic version of what you could be understood as a Vedic mantra. It is, or a hymn or something like that. It is our sung prayers, because our prayers are supposed to be sung. So that is what Galdr is. And Galdr is a form of magic as well. Andre just beautifully said earlier about how speaking the name of the bear is a form of magic. Well, Galdr is magic too. It is a form of devotional magic that you use. We consider, you know, the mantras and the hymns and all this, we consider this stuff magic. The problem when people hear the term magic among modern people, they associate it with, one, either fiction, which we love fiction here. You know, we love Lord of the Rings, we love Conan the Barbarian, we love these things, right? But that either modern people either conflate magic with that, or they look at this kind of like goofy like Wicca stuff where they think that that they can just like summon spirits and like all this kind of stuff, where they have these completely ridiculous made up stories about how whatever they put curses on people. And I'm saying there probably are people out there that have the ability to curse. Whoa. And hex. Go ahead.
Oh, I didn't mean to cut you off or anything, but I was going to say, I think there probably are ways to do that, but that's some really heavy stuff that you shouldn't be looking into anyway.
Yeah, and we're not supposed to look into that kind of stuff. That's considered ergy. That is.
Yeah, that's literally seat there. That's Arbota's domain, and we don't mess with that.
No, that's, you know, our ancestors viewed that you should confront your problems, and you should deal with, if you have a problem with somebody, you should handle it in court at the thing, and be a man. That is what ergi means, is ergi means not manly. It means unbecoming of man.
Unmanly, yeah.
It means you're being a little bitch.
Well, like poison. Poison. Yeah, poison and Saether are kind of the same thing, you know, like Saether is spiritual poison because it's a coward's weapon. It's a weapon for someone that doesn't dare confront their foe face to face.
Yeah, Eidolon says cursing someone is Saether, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Cursing someone is Saether. And if you do that, you're considered a little bitch. You're considered somebody that is unmanly, and you should handle these things like men, either at a thing in a court overseen by folk and tribe and the leaders of your community, or you need to handle it in the ring and fight it out. You know, you could either handle it by doing good business, or you can handle it with violence. One thing that's off the table completely is using underhanded methods. You know, that's why like things like slander and things like talking behind people's backs and like these kinds of things are considered ergi as well. Slander is a very neath. Is actually one of the neaths. It's I guess you could say high sins. But going back to the magic. Would I consider music an essential part of Germanic spirituality? Absolutely not. Also, Mark says, the idea that Galdr is just chanting rune names possibly comes from the Kabbalah and has nothing to do with actual Galdr. That's right. That's actually true. For folks listening that still do kind of like runic chants and stuff like that, I'm not going to tell you to stop. If you really like that and it benefits you, okay. But it is not an authentic way to perform Galdr. Galdr is our sung prayers, and for us in the Sedian nation, we directly take lines out of the Eddas and use that as Galdr. The next question is the same guy, Mr. James. He asks, what instruments do you think are folk considered sacred? Obviously harp. Obviously the ones that we know about, tagelharpa, stringed instruments, drums were considered sacred.
The horn,
absolutely considered sacred. If you want to go back to Indo-Europeans, they were very musical people. Indo-Europeans from the steppe all the way to the Germanics have always been very musical people. Always, we see there's tons and tons of instruments that they find in burials and digs. It was a big thing to them. It was a big thing to them.
Well, you know, this is kind of a side note, but it's something I find interesting on that note is that a lot of pop culture-y stuff kind of likes to use that Mongolian throat style singing when it comes to like Norse things. And while that is totally like kind of a, from what I know, like a modern thing, it's not historically accurate. I think it does complement the subject matter pretty well because it's very guttural, a lot like the Germanic languages are. But it's also, you know, it's sung. It's like it's a good way for peoples like that to convey themselves. And so it very much, I guess it has like that steppe energy, I guess you could say, be it Mongolian or, you know, Indo-European.
I would actually
disagree.
But,
you know, the war horn, really.
Yeah, okay. I would actually disagree. There are sources that reference people. I believe it was Ibn Fadlan said that he saw the Germanic people speaking, or maybe it was Tacitus. One of the sources, secondary sources, referred to the Germanic people making this sound with their voices behind their shields, and it sounded like a chorus of growling dogs or something like that. And if you look at Mongolian throat singing. Mongolian throat singing is that, you know, the really kind of growly, guttural stuff.
Yeah.
And it's if you look at the Mongolians themselves as people, they are physiologically closer to us than the other Asiatics because we have, you know, we share some genetics with them, right?
I mean, my point with that was kind of that, like, even though they are different, it does complement our stuff very well because of, you know, in our really archaic way, a shared root. Because I really do think that ultimately the Mongols and a lot of the original Turkic peoples were influenced by or had a lot of genetic interaction with the Indo-Europeans because they're just hyper similar in a lot of ways, you know, from the Scythians to the Wusun and the Xiongnu and all that. But
yeah,
totally off topic for that. I don't want to drag us down that hole.
And, once upon a time I was a musician and I did extreme metal stuff. The throat singing, the muscles in your vocal cords that you use to do that Mongolian style, very raspy, growly kind of stuff, are the same vocal muscles that you use to do death metal vocals. Look all around the world, and you know, death metal is most popular in Europe and among Western countries. However, there are huge like death metal scenes all over the world, South and Central America, in the Middle East, in India. There's a lot of people that do it. Who does it the best? Generates these like death metal vocal legends? Europeans. Europeans do it the best because we have the very thick vocal cords to do this. So we have similar vocal cords to the Mongolians. And also, look at the popularity of that band, The Who. Like, what was that song, The Wolf Totem? Whoa. That went nuts.
Well, there's a lot more than I would say that there's even a lot of better bands better than The Who, but Tengger Cavalry, even though the lead singer passed away, Nine Treasures, like in Inner Mongolia, which is a province of northern China, you know, only by imperialist standards, though, and Mongolia itself, they both have really big metal scenes, but that kind of like folk metal, when they use a lot of the horsehead fiddle and classical instruments in it, because it does complement that style of music pretty well, and it's just really popular there and increasingly globally. I mean, I like it a lot, personally.
Yeah, so what I'm getting at, though, is that got so popular, especially, like how many people got into that? You know, white guys got into that. Why? Well, I think it triggered something that sounds familiar to them. You know, the Mongolian style of throat singing. So I strongly believe we know that the Germanics throat sung, and if they throat sung, I you know, it's not provable, obviously, but I am very strongly argue that Germanic throat singing would have sounded like the Mongolian style, just because, you know, for everything that I just said there. So let's move on to the next stuff here. Actually, Mark says, what did he say here? He had something good that he was going to say. He said that there's a saga that describes a form of throat singing, and he just posted a source here in the chat, so if you guys want to check that out, all that stuff. So we're going to move on because we're starting to run out of time a little bit. We're halfway through. Let me bring it up here. There's instruments. What types of rites of passage did our ancestors practice before the conversion? Do you guys have any answers for that?
That's also a good one, and I really wish we had the proper sources here, but I would like what you're dealing with here before conversion is also something that you would see at least like somewhat after conversion, where you had a lot of these specific life events that would be celebrated, such as the, I believe, for instance, the when your child is 9 days old. That is when it's supposed to receive its name.
Yeah. I think that he's talking about, like, naming ceremonies and, like, rites of passage into adulthood.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's part of what I was talking about here. Like, that is when you would give the child its name and the father would accept the child into its family.
Yeah, that would be a naming ceremony. As far as rites of passage, actually, this question and the next question, I need to get Mark on here. Mark is the rites of passage guy. He is all in it. He's been studying it for quite a few months now. And the next question is going to be, I'm going to do an overview of what this is. And then one day we're going to get Mark on and we're going to talk about this in depth. God King Cthulhu 138, he says, that's my boy, explain the nine squares and its uses. What he's talking about here is called the nine-square grid, or the Grindr. And the Grindr is It is a grid of 9 squares that we can demonstrate is a very, very holy symbol. It is we use it for our stalies, for our altars, our altar tables. And what it references is the underworld, because in Germanic ritual, a lot of times what we're doing is we are invoking or reenacting these kinds of these myths that have to do with creation, that have to do with primordial creation, that have to do with the cosmology, that have to do with these things. So what the 9 square grid is like a macro, micro kind of creation of the underworld. And it's a very holy kind of symbol. So we can get we'll get all into it. I promise I'll get Mark on and he will yak our ears off about that because that is an area of his close study. Next question, we have Wolfgar. He asks, do we know what happens to Surt at Ragnarok?
Like after the fact? I don't think it's ever actually said what happens to Surt, but given that he's not mentioned as going on into the next world, I think it's fairly safe to assume that he perishes in some way or another.
Yeah, we did a whole episode talking about the Jotuns, and actually we did 2 episodes talking about the Jotuns. So if you want to go, I believe we did talk about Surt at length in those episodes. So if you want to go check them out, one is called just Jotunheim, one is just called Jotnar or something like that. So
I think Will Reeves has done a publication too on Surt and his origins and the Sons of Surt. That might be something you'd want to check out too.
Yeah. So moving on, we have Grief. I believe Grief is from the Sunriders. If he's from the Sunriders, much love to the Sunriders. I'm a big fan of the Sunriders. So favorite hero in the sagas or elsewhere and why? Mr. Andre. Oh,
that's a good question, actually. I'm actually not sure if I have a proper answer for who my actual favorite might be.
Give us one that you like a lot.
Oh God, I'm drawing a blank right now.
Got somebody?
What was the question? I got the tail end of it.
Favorite hero in the sagas or elsewhere, and why?
Ooh, that's tough. Probably Sigurd the Dragon Slayer, just because it, like, one of my earliest memories was specifically the scene of him roasting Fafnir's heart and the birds telling him of Regan's plans. But it's just kind of always been like familial to me, in the sense that my paternal origins in Germany are from a town that's not far from Sigurd's historic capital, supposedly. And it's just a story that I grew up with. But I also like Heidrek a lot from the Tyrfing cycle. I think he's a very tragic kind of anti-hero. Our lore is full of, you know, larger than life figures and heroes that are all really, really good figures in any literary sense, you know, a lot better than modern fiction, I would say, in most cases. But yeah, I would say Sigurd is mine.
So, Andre, did you think of something?
Yes. I remembered now that my favorite is Egil Skallagrimson.
Good one.
I like Skallagrimson quite a bit, simply because I wouldn't necessarily call him an anti-hero, but he's not your typical heroic hero figure. But he shows qualities that are both usual and somewhat unusual for typical hero figures, because he's not out there fighting dragons with swords or anything like that. The guy's out there insulting people with poetry and making them want to kill themselves because they feel so ashamed.
Based. Very
based. He's very based.
So my favorite hero isn't in the sagas, but the name that came to my mind when you asked this was King Skef. And I talked about King Skef at great length when we did our Return of the Kings episode. So I'm not going to go on my usual 20-minute tirade about how much I love King Skef. But King Skef, why he's my favorite is because he is sort of number one, he's sort of living evidence for divine intervention on Earth. He is justification for our belief in the holy gods. And that is because of his mysterious origin, because he did live and he was real. Many Many kings reference him as the who sired them. You know, Alboan, I believe the Aethelings, the Skildungs, living people said that he was there. You know, he was a real guy, and he was a real guy, and his story is incredible. He's probably the OG primordial Germanic king and the living father. In fact, speaking of Mr. Mark and some of the guys in Rona Society believe that he was an incarnation of Heimdall, or he was Heimdall under a different name. And he is also Rig, that he was the father of Rig Sula. And all of those things make sense to me. So King Skef is my favorite hero.
I wouldn't
king.
Call him a hero. All right, I wouldn't call him a hero, but I also really like the story of Voland. You know, Voland's revenge is kind of a very tragic tale.
So tell us why you like it.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it's just kind of that whole, I mean, there is the theory, whether you accept it or not, and I do, that Voland and Thiazi are the same figure, you know, sons of Ivaldi and whatnot. And with kind of that in mind, it's just this story of like a master smith and like craftsman who was, you know, spited and, you know, kind of withdrew to, you know, the Wolfdales, his kind of creepy forest home, where he just kind of lived like a hermit almost until tragedy and misfortune befell him. And then, you know, in his bitterness and spite, he, you know, kind of enacts his revenge, which, you know, to a cruel and, you know, asshole king, he, you know, makes him suffer greatly, you know, what with the punishments rendered unto his children and such before he flies away. You know, in a way almost similar to, you know, the flight of Icarus, except with different themes and whatnot. But it's just a story of, you know, to me, you know, a semi-divine figure who is wronged by, you know, mortals or semi-mortals, and then, you know, extracts his revenge upon them. And I like that. It's a good story. It's also a very good warning about letting hubris and grief and rage kind of consume you, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. So, the next
ultimately,
one...
what Voland does is, oh, sorry.
Oh, no, go right ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that ultimately, like, the tragedy with him is that, you know, what he does is cruel and savage and whatnot. And it's not really that he's justified in doing so, because, you know, a lot of it is kind of not so justifiable in a lot of ways. But it's, you know, of someone that was once really great and admired, kind of letting their own bitterness consume and corrupt them. So it's almost kind of a warning into not letting negative emotion kind of cloud your judgment, or, you know, to change your lifestyle to the point that it makes you toxic, in a sense.
Yeah. So, very good. Very cool. Next up is a question that we don't have time to answer tonight. And this is something that I would actually like to get Tristan on, but I want to give him a shout to let him know that I saw his question. It's from Primal Might Kindred. And he's got a question regarding the Thurses and chaos and the nature of chaos and the nature of the Jotun and how it all plays together. So it's a really big question.
Oh,
and so, we're going to save that for another time, but Mr. Whoever you are from Primal Might Kindred, I just want to let you know, I did see your question and we will answer it on air, very soon. We're going to do one more on the list here, and then we're going to go over to the chat and see what folks are asking. Big Surge, our boy Srujan, says, what symbols would you guys put on your crests if you had one? I do have a crest, Mr. Surge, and my crest features two distal finks, which are the kind of the totem animal of Pennsylvania. It has antlers. It has quite a few elements. It has a hex sign, which is another. My crest is very, as we would say in PA, it's very Dutchy, right? It's very Dutchy. So there are quite a few elements there. I could maybe do a video explaining what they all mean and everything like that. But so you guys are kind of in the process of creating crests. What symbols would you guys use or are using, and why? Let's start with Mr. Ian.
For me personally, or as like a greater clan sort of thing?
As a greater clan sort of thing.
Well, given that, you know, I'm in kind of the greater Sonoran region, borderland type of thing, and given that Loki and, you know, a lot of deceitful Jotun are oftentimes kind of described being like serpents and whatnot, Thought it was kind of cool to get like a Mexican wolf because, you know, I personally am involved with like lobo conservation and reintroduction and such. So I thought it was cool to kind of like take the Mexican flag of the golden eagle, like devouring the serpent kind of thing, but changing it to a lobo, like tearing a rattlesnake apart in its teeth, you know, kind of mimic that flag because it's semi-regional, but also to kind of put our own like spin on it in the sense that the way I look at it is it's like either Geri or Freki, like tearing apart like Loki or, you know, just a Jotun in theory, you know, with their teeth. It's kind of a, you know, Lokians not welcome. Is the overarching
for me is a predominantly a boar or a boar's head, most likely a boar, an anchor, and a cormorant.
What's a cormorant?
Also said to carry the souls of dead sailors at times, similar to how albatrosses and such were seen back in the day as well. Mm-hmm. They're seen as like almost weirdly ethereal creatures because they are often seen on cliffs and skerries and so forth where they are sitting with their wings extended, drawing them out. So they look like almost like weird hanged people at times, especially if you see them in the mist. Because I'm a maritime person from a very maritime region and my family has been fishermen for as far back as we can remember, more or less. That has been what we have been doing. Sailors and fishermen, that's it. The boar is a particular favorite of mine. It's one of my favorite animals of all time because it's a pissed off pig and it's going to ruin your day.
Basically.
It's usually a pretty chill animal unless you get it mad.
Meanings behind them and they convey things, regions and different deities and they reference other families and clans of old, and you know there's a lot of meaning and stuff that goes into crests, and it's not really, we can't really give a full thing to the science of the Germanic armorial right now, but it's a wonderful questions in the chat here. And one of them was really interesting. We kind of went through this pretty recently, but we're going to talk about it real, real quick before we run out of time. M14 asks, thoughts on Neoplatonism as a form of paganism?
Oh. Ah.
Oh.
That's a big no for me, guy.
No, that's a big no. Big fat no.
So Neoplatonism, I would not put around. We kind of view Neoplatonism as like the first Wicca. It's like the first New Ageism. And
Wicca for ancients.
Yeah, it's like ancient Wicca is what we kind of view it as. Because
ancient Roman Wicca, yeah.
Yeah, because it sort of completely ignores what is demonstrated in the myth, in the myths, which we do believe, you know, people that are hard polytheists, I guess you could say, view their myths as the story of their people, the story of their folk, and our philosophy coincides, it sprouts from what is the basis, which is the lore.